I soon realized Piper didn't need to rely on charm speak to persuade people. She carried herself with confidence, striding from ship to ship like she was supposed to be there. The yachts were lightly guarded, perhaps because most of the Pandai and Strixes had already flown over to check out the lightning strike on Ship 26. The few mortal mercenaries we passed gave Piper no more than a brief glance. Since I followed in her wake, they ignored me too. I supposed if they were used to working side by side with Cyclopes and Big Ears, they could overlook a couple of teenagers in riot gear. Boat 28 was a floating water park, with multi-level swimming pools connected by waterfalls, slides, and transparent tubes. A lonely lifeguard offered us a towel as we walked by. He looked sad when we didn't take one. Boat 29, a full-service spa. Steam poured from every open porthole. On the aft deck, an army of bored-looking masseuses and cosmeticians stood ready, just in case Caligula decided to drop by with 50 friends for a shiatsu and mani-pedi party. I was tempted to stop, just for a quick shoulder massage. But since Piper, daughter of Aphrodite, marched right past without a glance at the offerings, I decided not to embarrass myself. Boat 30 was a literal movable feast. The entire ship seemed designed to provide an all-you-can-eat 24-hour buffet, which no one was partaking in. Chefs stood by, waiters waited. New dishes were brought out and old ones removed. I suspected the uneaten food, enough to feed the greater Los Angeles area, would be dumped overboard. Typical Caligula extravagance. Your ham sandwich tastes so much better when you know hundreds of identical sandwiches had been thrown away as your chefs waited for you to get hungry. Our good luck failed on boat 31. As soon as we crossed the red-carpeted ramp onto the bow, I knew we were in trouble. Groups of off-duty mercenaries lounged here and there, talking, eating, checking their cell phones. We got more frowns, more questioning looks. From the tension in Piper's posture, I could tell she sensed the problem, too. But before I could say, "Gosh, Piper, I think we've stumbled into Caligula's floating barracks and we're about to die," she forged ahead, doubtless deciding it would be as dangerous to backtrack as to bluff our way through. She was wrong. On the aft deck, we found ourselves in the middle of a Cyclops-slash-mortal volleyball game. In a sand-filled pit, half a dozen hairy Cyclopes in swim trunks battled it out with half a dozen equally hairy mortals in combat pants. Around the edges of the game, more off-duty mercenaries were barbecuing steaks on a grill, laughing, sharpening knives, and comparing tattoos. At the grill, a double-wide dude with a flat-top haircut and a chest tattoo that read "Mother" spotted us and froze.
"Hey!"
The volleyball game stopped. Everyone on deck turned and glowered at us. Piper pulled off her helmet. "Apollo, back me up." I feared she might pull a Meg and charge into battle. In that case, backing her up would mean getting ripped limb from limb by sweaty ex-military types, which was not on my bucket list. Instead, Piper began to sing. I wasn't sure what surprised me more, Piper's beautiful voice or the tune she chose. I recognized it immediately. "Life of Illusion" by Joe Walsh. The 1980s were something of a blur to me, but that song I remembered. 1981, the very beginning of MTV. Oh, the lovely videos I'd produced for Blondie and the Go-Go's. The amount of hairspray and leopard print spandex we had used. The crowd of mercenaries listened in confused silence. Should they kill us now? Should they wait for us to finish? It wasn't every day someone serenaded you with Joe Walsh in the middle of a volleyball game. I'm sure the mercenaries were a little fuzzy on the proper etiquette. After a couple of lines, Piper gave me a sharp glance like, "A little help?" Ah, she wanted me to back her up with music. With great relief, I whipped out my ukulele and played along. In truth, Piper's voice needed no help. She belted out the lyrics with passion and clarity, a shockwave of emotion that was more than a heartfelt performance, more than charm speak. She moved through the crowd, singing of her own illusionary life. She inhabited the song. She invested the words with pain and sorrow, turning Walsh's peppy tune into a melancholy confessional. She spoke of breaking through walls of confusion, of enduring the little surprises nature had thrown at her, of jumping to conclusions about who she was. She didn't change the lyrics. Nevertheless, I felt her story in every line. Her struggle as a neglected child of a famous movie star, her mixed feelings about discovering she was a daughter of Aphrodite. Most hurtful of all, her realization that the supposed love of her life, Jason Grace, was not someone she wanted to be with romantically. I didn't understand it all, but the power of her voice was undeniable. My ukulele responded. My chords turned more resonant, my riffs more soulful. Every note I played was a cry of sympathy for Piper McLean, my own musical skill amplifying hers. The guards became unfocused. Some sat down, cradling their heads in their hands. Some stared into space and let their steaks burn on the grill. None of them stopped us as we crossed the aft deck. None followed us across the bridge to boat 32. We were halfway across that yacht before Piper finished her song and leaned heavily against the nearest wall. Her eyes were red, her face hollowed out with emotion. Piper? I stared at her in amazement. How did you... Shoes now, she croaked. Talk later. She stumbled on. Chapter 28. Apollo disguised. As Apollo. Disguised as... Nah, too depressing. We saw no sign that the mercenaries were pursuing us. How could they? Even hardened warriors could not be expected to give chase after such a performance. I imagine they were sobbing in each other's arms, or rifling through the yacht for extra boxes of tissues. We made our way through the 30s of Caligula's super yacht chain, using stealth when necessary, mostly relying on the apathy of the crew members we encountered. Caligula had always inspired fear in his servants, but that didn't equate to loyalty. No one asked us any questions. On boat 40, Piper collapsed. I rushed to help, but she pushed me away. I'm okay, she muttered. You are not okay, I said. You probably have a concussion. You just worked a powerful bit of musical charm. You need a minute to rest. We don't have a minute. I was fully aware of that. Sporadic bursts of gunfire still crackled over the harbor from the direction we had come. The harsh scree of Strixes pierced the night sky. Our friends were buying us time, and we had none to waste. This was also the night of the new moon. Whatever plans Caligula had for Camp Jupiter, far to the north, they were happening now. I could only hope Leo had reached the Roman demigods, and that they could fend off whatever evil came their way. Being powerless to help them was a terrible feeling. It made me anxious not to waste a moment. Nevertheless, I told Piper, I really don't have time for you to die on me, or go into a coma. So you will take a moment to sit. Let's get out of the open. Piper was too weak to protest much. In her present condition, I doubted she could have charm-spoken her way out of a parking ticket. I carried her inside Yacht 40, which turned out to be dedicated to Caligula's wardrobe. We passed room after room filled with clothes. Suits, togas, armor, dresses. Why not? And a variety of costumes from pirate to Apollo to panda bear. Again, why not? I was tempted to dress up as Apollo, just to feel sorry for myself. But I didn't want to take the time to apply the gold paint. Why did mortals always think I was gold? I mean, I could be gold, but the shininess detracted from my naturally amazing looks. Correction. My former naturally amazing looks. Finally, we found a dressing room with the couch. I moved a pile of evening dresses, then ordered Piper to sit. I pulled out a crushed square of ambrosia and ordered her to eat it. My goodness, I could be bossy when I had to be. At least that was one godly power I hadn't lost. While Piper nibbled her divine energy bar, I stared glumly at the racks of bespoke finery. Why can't the shoes be here? This is his wardrobe boat, after all. Come on, Apollo. Piper winced as she shifted on the cushions. Everybody knows you need a separate superyacht just for shoes. I can't tell if you're joking. She picked up a Stella McCartney dress. A lovely low-cut number in scarlet silk. Nice. Then she pulled out her knife, gritting her teeth from the effort, and slit the gown right down the front. That felt good, she decided. It seemed pointless to me. You couldn't hurt Caligula by ruining his things. He had all the things. Nor did it seem to make Piper any happier. Thanks to the ambrosia, her color was better. Her eyes were not as dulled with pain. But her expression remained stormy, like her mother's whenever she heard someone praise Scarlett Johansson's good looks. Tip. Never mention Scarlett Johansson around Aphrodite. The song you sang to the mercenaries, I ventured. Life of Illusion. The corners of Piper's eyes tightened, as if she'd known this conversation was coming but was too tired to deflect it. It's an early memory. Right after my dad got his first big acting break, he was blasting that song in the car. We were driving to our new house. The place in Malibu. He was singing to me. We were both so happy. I must have been, I don't know, in kindergarten? But the way you sang it, you seemed to be talking about yourself. Why you broke up with Jason? She studied her knife. The blade remained blank, devoid of visions. I tried, she murmured. After the war with Gia, I convinced myself everything would be perfect. For a while, a few months maybe, I thought it was. Jason's great. He's my closest friend, even more than Annabeth, but... She spread her hands. Whatever I thought was there, my happily ever after, it just wasn't. I nodded. Your relationship was born in crisis. Such romances are difficult to sustain once the crisis is over. It wasn't just that. A century ago, I dated Grand Duchess Tatiana Romanov, I recalled. Things were great between us during the Russian Revolution. She was so stressed, so scared, she really needed me. Then the crisis passed, and the magic just wasn't there anymore. Wait, actually, that could have been because she was shot to death along with the rest of her family, but still, it was me. My thoughts had been drifting through the Winter Palace, through the acrid gun smoke and bitter cold of 1917. Now I snapped back to the present. What do you mean it was you? You mean you realized you didn't love Jason? That's no one's fault. She grimaced. As if I still hadn't grasped what she meant, or perhaps she wasn't sure herself. I know it's nobody's fault, she said. I do love him. But, like I told you, Hera forced us together. The marriage goddess, arranging a happy couple. My memories of starting to date Jason our first few months together were a total illusion. Then, as soon as I found that out, before I could even process what it meant, Aphrodite claimed me. My mom. The goddess of love. She shook her head in dismay. Aphrodite pushed me into thinking I was... that I needed to... She sighed. Look at me. The great charm speaker. I don't even have words. Aphrodite expects her daughters to wrap men around our little fingers, break their hearts, etc. I remembered the many times Aphrodite and I had fallen out. I was a sucker for romance. Aphrodite always had fun sending tragic lovers my way. Yes, your mother has definite ideas about how romance should be. So if you take that away, Piper said, the goddess of marriage pushing me to settle down with a nice boy, the goddess of love pushing me to be the perfect romantic lady or whatever. You're wondering who you are without all that pressure. She stared at the remains of the scarlet evening dress. For the Cherokee, like traditionally speaking, your heritage comes from your mom's side. The clan she comes from is the clan you come from. The dad's side doesn't really count. She let out a brittle laugh. Which means, technically, I'm not Cherokee. I don't belong to any of the 7 main clans, because my mom is a Greek goddess. Ah. So, I mean, do I even have that to define myself? The last few months, I've been trying to learn more about my heritage. Picking up my granddad's blowgun, talking to my dad about family history to take his mind off stuff. But what if I'm not any of the things I've been told I am? I have to figure out who I am. Have you come to any conclusions? She brushed her hair behind her ear. I'm in process. I could appreciate that. I, too, was in process. It was painful. A line from the Joe Walsh song reverberated in my head. Nature loves her little surprises, I said. Piper snorted. She sure does. I stared at the rows of Caligula's outfits, everything from wedding gowns to Armani suits to gladiator armor. It's been my observation, I said, that you humans are more than the sum of your history. You can choose how much of your ancestry to embrace. You can overcome the expectations of your family and your society. What you cannot do, and should never do, is try to be someone other than yourself. Piper McLean. She gave me a wry smile. That's nice. I like that. You're sure you're not the god of wisdom? I applied for the job, I said, but they gave it to someone else. Something about inventing olives? I rolled my eyes. Piper burst out laughing, which made me feel as if a good strong wind had finally blown all the wildfire smoke out of California. I grinned in response. When was the last time I'd had such a positive exchange with an equal? A friend? A kindred soul? I could not recall. All right, oh wise one. Piper struggled to her feet. We'd better go. We've got a lot more boats to trespass on. Boat 41. Lingerie department. I will spare you the frilly details. Boat 42. A regular superyacht, with a few crew members who ignored us, 2 mercenaries whom Piper charmed into jumping overboard, and a 2-headed man whom I shot in the groin. By pure luck, and made disintegrate. Why would you put a regular boat between your clothes boat and your shoe boat? Piper wondered. That's just bad organization. She sounded remarkably calm. My own nerves were starting to fray. I felt like I was splitting into pieces, the way I used to when several dozen Greek cities all prayed for me to manifest my glorious self at the same time in different places. It's so annoying when cities don't coordinate their holy days. We crossed the port side, and I caught a glimpse of movement in the sky above us. A pale gliding shape much too big to be a seagull. When I looked again, it was gone. "I think we're being followed," I said. "Our friend Crest." Piper scanned the night sky. "What do we do about it?" "I'd recommend nothing," I said. "If he wanted to attack us or raise the alarm, he could have already done it." Piper did not look happy about our big-eared stalker, but we kept moving. At last, we reached Iulia Drusilla the 43rd, the fabled ship of shoes. This time, thanks to the tip-off from Amax and his men, we expected Pandai guards, led by the fearsome Wawa. We were better prepared to deal with them. As soon as we stepped onto the foredeck, I readied my ukulele. Piper said very quietly, "Wow, I hope nobody overhears our secrets." Instantly, four Pandai came running, two from the port side and two from starboard, all stumbling over each other to get to us first. As soon as I could see the whites of their tragi, I strummed a C-minor-6 tritone chord at top volume, which to creatures with such exquisite hearing must have felt like getting Q-tipped with live electric wires. The Pandai screeched and fell to their knees, giving Piper time to disarm them and zip-tie them thoroughly. Once they were properly hogtied, I stopped my torturous ukulele assault. "Which of you is Wawa?" I demanded. The Pandos on the far left snarled.
"Who wants to know?"
"Hello, Wawa," I said. "We're looking for the Emperor's magical shoes. You know, the ones that let him navigate the burning maze. You could save us a lot of time by telling us where they are on board." He thrashed and cursed.
"Never!"
"Or," I said, "I'll let my friend Piper do the searching while I stay here and serenade you with my out-of-tune ukulele. Are you familiar with Tiptoe Through the Tulips by Tiny Tim?" Wawa spasmed with terror.
"Deck 2, port side, third door!" he spluttered. "Please, no Tiny Tim! No Tiny Tim!"
"Enjoy your evening," I said. We left them in peace and went to find some footwear. Chapter 29. A horse is a horse, of course, and no one can... Run! He'll kill you! A floating mansion full of shoes. Hermes would have been in paradise. Not that he was the official god of shoes, mind you. But as patron deity of travelers, he was the closest thing we Olympians had. Hermes's collection of Air Jordans was unrivaled. He had closets full of winged sandals, rows of patent leather, racks of blue suede, and don't get me started on his roller skates. I still have nightmares about him skating through Olympus with his big hair and gym shorts and high-striped socks, listening to Donna Summer on his Walkman. As Piper and I made our way to Deck 2, portside, we passed illuminated podiums displaying designer pumps, a hallway lined floor-to-ceiling with shelves of red leather boots, and one room with nothing but soccer cleats, for reasons I couldn't fathom. The room Wawa had directed us to seemed to be more about quality than quantity. It was the size of a goodly apartment, with windows that overlooked the sea so the Emperor's prized shoes could have a nice view. In the middle of the room, a comfortable pair of couches faced a coffee table with a collection of exotic bottled waters, just in case you got thirsty and needed to rehydrate between putting on the left shoe and the right. As for the shoes themselves, along the fore and aft walls were rows of... "Whoa," Piper said. I thought that summed it up rather well. Rose of Woe. On one pedestal sat a pair of Hephaestus's battle boots. Huge contraptions, with spiked heels and toes, built-in chainmail socks, and laces that were tiny bronze automaton serpents to prevent unauthorized wearers. On another pedestal, in a clear acrylic box, a pair of winged sandals fluttered around, trying to escape. "Could those be the ones we need?" Piper asked. "We could fly right through the maze." The idea was appealing, but I shook my head. Winged shoes are tricky. If we put them on and they're enchanted to take us to the wrong place... "Oh, right," Piper said. "Percy told me about a pair that almost... never mind." We examined the other pedestals. Some held shoes that were merely one of a kind. Platform boots studded with diamonds. Dress shoes made from the skin of the now extinct dodo. Rude. Or a pair of Adidas signed by all the players of the 1987 LA Lakers. Other shoes were magical and labeled as such. A pair of slippers woven by Hypnos to give pleasant dreams and deep sleep. A pair of dancing shoes fashioned by my old friend Terpsichore, the muse of dance. I'd only seen a few of those over the years. Astaire and Rogers both had a pair. So did Baryshnikov. Then there was a pair of Poseidon's old loafers, which would ensure perfect beach weather, good fishing, gnarly waves, and excellent tanning. Those loafers sounded pretty good to me. "There." Piper pointed to an old pair of leather sandals casually tossed in the corner of the room. "Can we assume the least likely shoes are actually the most likely?" I didn't like that assumption. I preferred it when the most likely to be popular or wonderful or talented turned out to be the one who was the most popular, wonderful, or talented, because that was normally me. Still, in this case, I thought Piper might be right. I knelt next to the sandals. "These are Caligae, Legionnaire's shoes." I hooked one finger and lifted the shoes by the straps. There wasn't much to them. Just leather soles and laces, worn soft and darkened with age. They looked like they'd seen many marches, but they'd been kept well-oiled and lovingly maintained through the centuries. "Caligae," Piper said. "Like Caligula." "Exactly," I agreed. "These are the adult version of the little booties that gave Gaius Julius Caesar Germanicus his childhood nickname." Piper wrinkled her nose. "Can you sense any magic?" "Well, they're not buzzing with energy," I said, "or giving me flashbacks of stinky feet, or compelling me to put them on. But I think they're the right shoes. These are his namesake. They carry his power." "Hmm. I suppose if you can talk to an arrow, you can read a pair of sandals." "It's a gift," I agreed. She knelt next to me and took one of the sandals. "This won't fit me. Way too big. They look about your size." "Are you implying I have big feet?" Her smile flickered. "These look almost as uncomfortable as the shoes of shame. This horrible white pair of nurse's shoes we had back in the Aphrodite cabin. You'd have to wear them as punishment if you did something bad." "That sounds like Aphrodite." "I got rid of them," she said. "But these... I suppose as long as you don't mind putting your feet where Caligula's feet have been."
"Danger!" cried a voice behind us.
Sneaking up behind someone and yelling danger is an excellent way to make them simultaneously leap, spin, and fall on their butts, which is what Piper and I did. In the doorway stood Crest, his white fur matted and dripping, as if he'd flown through Caligula's swimming pool. His eight-fingered hands wrapped around the doorframe on either side. His chest heaved. His black suit was torn to pieces.
"Strixes!"
he panted. My heart leaped into my nasal cavity. Are they following you? He shook his head, his ears rippling like startled squids.
I think I evaded them, but...
Why are you here? Piper demanded, her hand going to her dagger. The look in Crest's eyes was a mixture of panic and hunger. He pointed to my ukulele.
You can show me how to play?
Yes, I said. Though a guitar might be better, given the size of your hands.
That chord, he said. The one that made Wawa screech? I want it.
I rose slowly, so as not to startle him further. Knowledge of the C minor 6 trichord is an awesome responsibility. But yes, I could show you.
And you.
He looked at Piper.
The way you sing, can you teach me?
Piper's hand dropped from her hilt. I guess I could try, but...
Then we must leave now,
Crest said.
They have already captured your friends.
What?
Piper got to her feet.
Are you sure? The scary girl. The lightning boy? Yes.
I swallowed back my despair. Crest had given a flawless description of Meg and Jason.
Where? I asked. Who has them?
Him, Crest said. The Emperor. His people will be here soon. We must fly. Be the musicians in the world.
Under different circumstances, I would have considered this excellent advice. But not with our friends captured. I wrapped up the Emperor's sandals and stuffed them into the bottom of my quiver.
Can you take us to our friends?
No!
Crest wailed.
You will die! The sorceress!
Why did Crest not hear the enemies sneaking up behind him? I don't know. Perhaps Jason's lightning had left a ringing in his ears. Perhaps he was too distressed, too focused on us to guard his own back. Whatever the case, Crest hurtled forward, crashing face first into the box with the winged sandals. He collapsed on the carpet, the freed flying shoes kicking him repeatedly about the head. On his back glistened two deep impressions in the shape of horse hooves. In the doorway stood a majestic white stallion, his head just clearing the top of the frame. In a flash, I realized why the Emperor's yachts had such tall ceilings, wide hallways and doorways. They were designed to accommodate this horse.
Incitatus, I said.
He locked eyes with me as no horse should be able to do, his huge brown pupils glinting with malicious awareness.
Apollo?
Piper looked stunned, as one does when encountering a talking horse on a shoe yacht. She began to say, what the... Incitatus charged. He trampled straight over the coffee table and head-butted Piper against the wall with a sickening crunch. Piper dropped to the carpet. I rushed toward her, but the horse slammed me away. I landed on the nearest sofa.
Well now.
Incitatus surveyed the damage. The overturned pedestals and destroyed coffee table. Broken bottles of exotic spring water seeping into the carpet. Crest groaning on the floor, the flying shoes still kicking him. Piper unmoving, blood trickling from her nose, and me on the sofa, cradling my bruised ribs.
Sorry to intrude on your intrusion, he said. I had to knock the girl out quickly, you understand. I don't like charm speak.
His voice was the same as I'd heard while hiding in the dumpster behind Macro's military madness. Deep and world-weary, tinged with annoyance, as if he'd seen every possible stupid thing bipeds could do. I stared in horror at Piper McLean. She didn't appear to be breathing. I remember the words of the Sybil, especially that terrible word that began with D.
You killed her, I stammered.
Did I?
Incitatus nuzzled Piper's chest.
Nah, not yet,
but soon enough. Now come along. The Emperor wants to see you.
Chapter 30. I'll never leave you. Love will keep us together. Or glue. Glue works too. Some of my best friends are magic horses. Arion, the swiftest steed in the world, is my cousin, though he rarely comes to family dinners. The famous winged Pegasus is also a cousin, once removed, I think, since his mother was a Gorgon. I'm not sure how that works. And of course, the sun horses were my favorite steeds, though thankfully none of them talked. Incitatus, however, I didn't like him much. He was a beautiful animal, tall and muscular, his coat gleaming like a sunlit cloud. His silky white tail swished behind him as if daring any flies, demigods, or other pests to approach his hindquarters. He wore neither tack nor saddle, though golden horseshoes gleamed on his hooves. His very majesty grated on me. His jaded voice made me feel small and unimportant. But what I really hated were his eyes. Horse eyes should not be so cold and intelligent.
"Climb on," he said. "My boy is waiting."
"Your boy?" He bared his marble-white teeth.
"You know who I mean. Big C, Caligula, the new son who's gonna eat you for breakfast."
I sank deeper into the sofa cushions. My heart pounded. I had seen how fast Incitatus could move. I didn't like my chances against him alone. I would never be able to fire an arrow or strum a tune before he kicked my face in. This would have been an excellent time for a surge of godly strength, so I could throw the horse out the window. Alas, I felt no such energy within me. Nor could I expect any backup. Piper groaned, twitching her fingers. She looked half-conscious at best. Crest whimpered and tried to curl into a ball to escape the bullying of the winged shoes. I rose from the couch, clenched my hands into fists, and forced myself to look Incitatus in the eye. "I'm still the god Apollo," I warned. "I faced two emperors already. I beat them both. Don't test me, horse." Incitatus snorted.
"Whatever, Lester. You're getting weaker. We've been keeping an eye on you. You've got hardly anything left. Now quit stalling."
"And how will you force me to come with you?" I demanded. "You can't pick me up and throw me on your back. You have no hands, no opposable thumbs. That was your fatal mistake."
"Yeah, well, I could just kick you in the face, or..."
Incitatus snickered. A sound like someone calling their dog. Wawa and two of his guards slunk into the room.
"You called, Lord Stallion?"
The horse grinned at me.
"I don't need opposable thumbs when I've got servants. Granted, they're lame servants that I had to chew free from their own zip ties."
"Lord Stallion,"
Wawa protested.
"It was the ukulele. We couldn't..."
"Load 'em up,"
Incitatus ordered, "before you put me in a bad mood." Wawa and his helpers threw Piper across the horse's back. They forced me to climb up behind her. Then they bound my hands once again, this time in front at least, so I could better keep my balance. Finally, they pulled Crest to his feet. They wrangled the physically abusive winged shoes back into their box, zip-tied Crest's hands, and force-marched him in front of our grim little parade. We made our way up to the deck, me ducking under every lintel, and retraced our path across the floating bridge of super yachts. Incitatus trotted along at an easy pace. Whenever we passed mercenaries or crew members, they knelt and lowered their heads. I wanted to believe they were honoring me, but I suspected they were honoring the horse's ability to bash their heads in if they didn't show proper respect. Crest stumbled. The other Pandai hauled him to his feet and prodded him along. Piper kept slipping off the stallion's back, but I did my best to keep her in place. Once she muttered, "Unfu," which might have meant thank you, or untie me, or why does my mouth taste like a horseshoe? Her dagger, Catoptris, was in easy reach. I stared at the hilt, wondering if I could draw it quickly enough to cut myself free, or plunge it into the horse's neck.
"I wouldn't," Incitatus said.
I stiffened.
"What?"
"Use the knife. That'd be a bad move."
Are you a mind reader?"
The horse scoffed. "I don't need to read minds. You know how much you can tell from somebody's body language when they're riding your back?"
I can't say that I've had the experience."
"Well, I could tell what you were planning, so don't. I'd have to throw you off. Then you and your girlfriend would probably crack your heads and die."
"She's not my girlfriend."
"And Big C would be annoyed. He wants you to die in a certain way."
"Ah." My stomach felt as bruised as my ribs. I wondered if there was a special term for motion sickness while riding a horse on a boat. "So, when you said Caligula would eat me for breakfast..."
"Oh, I didn't mean that literally."
"Thank the gods."
"I meant the sorceress Medea will put you in chains and flay your human form to extract whatever remains of your godly essence. Then Caligula will consume your essence, yours and Helios's both, and make himself the new god of the sun."
"Oh." I felt faint. I assumed I still had some godly essence inside me. Some tiny spark of my former awesomeness that allowed me to remember who I was and what I had once been capable of. I didn't want those last vestiges of divinity taken away, especially if the process involved flaying. The idea made my stomach churn. I hoped Piper wouldn't mind terribly if I threw up on her.
You seem like a reasonable horse, Incitatus. Why are you helping someone as volatile and treacherous as Caligula?"
Incitatus whinnied.
"Volatile schmolatile. The boy listens to me. He needs me. Doesn't matter how violent or unpredictable he may seem to others, I can keep him under control. Use him to push through my agenda. I'm backing the right horse."
He didn't seem to recognize the irony of a horse backing the right horse. Also, I was surprised to hear that Incitatus had an agenda. Most equine agendas were fairly straightforward. Food, running, more food, a good brushing. Repeat as desired. "Does Caligula know that you're, using him?"
"Of course," said the horse. "Kid's not stupid. Once he gets what he wants, well, then we part ways. I intend to overthrow the human race and institute a government by the horses for the horses."
"You... what?"
"You think equine self-governance is any crazier than a world ruled by the Olympian gods?"
"I never thought about it."
"You wouldn't, would you? You with your bipedal arrogance. You don't spend your life with humans constantly expecting to ride you or have you pull their carts. Ah, I'm wasting my breath. You won't be around long enough to see the revolution."
Oh, listener, I can't express to you my terror. Not at the idea of a horse revolution, but at the thought that my life was about to end. Yes, I know mortals face death, too, but it's worse for a god, I tell you. I'd spent millennia knowing I was immune to the great cycle of life and death. Then suddenly I find out, LOL, not so much. I was going to be flayed and consumed by a man who took his cues from a militant talking horse. As we progressed down the chain of super yachts, we saw more and more signs of recent battle. Boat 20 looked like it had been struck repeatedly with lightning. Its superstructure was a charred, smoking ruin. The blackened upper decks spackled with fire extinguisher foam. Boat 18 had been converted into a triage center. The wounded were sprawled everywhere, groaning from bashed heads, broken limbs, bleeding noses, and bruised groins. Many of their injuries were at knee level or below, just where Meg McCaffrey liked to kick. A flock of Strixes wheeled overhead, screeching hungrily. Perhaps they were just on guard duty, but I got the feeling they were waiting to see which of the wounded did not pull through. Boat 14 was Meg McCaffrey's coup de grace. Boston Ivy had engulfed the entire yacht, including most of the crew, who were stitched to the walls by a thick web of crawlers. A cadre of horticulturists, no doubt called up from the botanical gardens on Boat 16, were now trying to free their comrades using clippers and weed whackers. I was heartened to see that our friends had made it this far and caused so much damage. Perhaps Crest had been mistaken about them being captured. Surely two capable demigods like Jason and Meg would have managed to escape if they got cornered. I was counting on it, since I now needed them to rescue me. But what if they could not? I racked my brain for clever ideas and devious schemes. Rather than racing, my mind moved at a wheezing jog. I managed to come up with phase one of my master plan. I would escape without getting myself killed, then free my friends. I was hard at work on phase two. How do I do that? When I ran out of time. Incitatus crossed to the deck of Iulia Drusilla the 12th, cantered through a set of double golden doors, and carried us down a ramp into the ship's interior, which contained a single, massive room. The audience chamber of Caligula. Entering this space was like plunging down the throat of a sea monster. I'm sure the effect was intentional. The Emperor wanted you to feel a sense of panic and helplessness. You have been swallowed, the room seemed to say. Now you will be digested. No windows here. The 50-foot-high walls screamed with garishly painted frescoes of battles, volcanoes, storms, wild parties. All images of power gone amok, boundaries erased. Nature overturned. The tiled floor was a similar study in chaos. Intricate, nightmarish mosaics of the gods being devoured by various monsters. Far above, the ceiling was painted black, and dangling from it were golden candelabras, skeletons in cages, and bare swords that hung by the thinnest of cords and looked ready to impale anyone below. I found myself tilting sideways on Incitatus's back, trying to find my equilibrium, but it was impossible. The chamber offered no safe place to rest my gaze. The rocking of the yacht didn't help. Standing guard along the length of the throne room were a dozen pandai, 6 to port and 6 to starboard. They held gold-tipped spears and wore golden chainmail from head to foot, including giant metal flaps over their ears that, when struck, must have given them terrible tinnitus. At the far end of the room, where the boat's hull narrowed to a point, the Emperor had set his dais, putting his back to the corner like any good paranoid ruler. Before him swirled two columns of wind and debris that I couldn't quite make sense of. Some sort of Ventus performance art? At the Emperor's right hand stood another Pandos, dressed in the full regalia of a Praetorian commander. Reverb, I guessed, captain of the guard. To the Emperor's left stood Medea, her eyes gleaming with triumph. The Emperor himself was much as I remembered. Young and lithe, handsome enough, though his eyes were too far apart, his ears too prominent. But not in comparison to the Pandai. His smile too thin. He was dressed in white slacks, white boat shoes, a striped blue and white shirt, a blue blazer, and a captain's hat. I had a horrible flashback to 1975, when I'd made the mistake of blessing Captain and Tennille with their hit single, Love Will Keep Us Together. If Caligula was the captain, that made Medea Tennille, which felt wrong on so many levels. I tried to push the thought from my mind. As our procession approached the throne, Caligula leaned forward and rubbed his hands, as if the next course of his dinner had just arrived.
"Perfect timing," he said. "I've been having the most fascinating conversation with your friends."
My friends? Only then did my brain allow me to process what was inside the swirling columns of wind. In one hovered Jason Grace, in the other Meg McCaffrey. Both struggled helplessly, both screamed without making a sound. Their tornado prisons whirled with glittering shrapnel. Tiny pieces of celestial bronze and imperial gold that sliced at their clothes and skin, slowly cutting them to pieces. Caligula rose, his placid brown eyes fixed on me.
"Incitatus, this can't actually be him, can it?"
"Afraid so, pal," said the horse. "May I present the pathetic excuse for a god, Apollo, also known as Lester Papadopoulos."
The stallion knelt on his forelegs, spilling Piper and me onto the floor. Chapter 31. I give you my heart. I mean, metaphorically. Put away that knife. I could think of many names to call Caligula. Pal was not one of them. Nevertheless, Incitatus seemed perfectly at home in the Emperor's presence. He trotted to starboard, where two Pandai began brushing his coat, while a third knelt to offer him oats from a golden bucket. Jason Grace lashed out in his wind tunnel of shrapnel, trying to break free. He cast a distressed look at Piper and yelled something I couldn't hear. In the other wind column, Meg floated with her arms and legs crossed, scowling like an angry genie, ignoring the bits of metal cutting her face. Caligula stepped down from his dais. He strolled between the wind columns with the jaunty lilt in his step, no doubt the effect of wearing a yacht captain outfit. He stopped a few feet in front of me. In his open palm, he bounced two small bits of gold. Meg McCaffrey's rings.
"This must be the lovely Piper McLean."
He frowned down at her, as if just realizing she was barely conscious.
"Why is she like this? I can't taunt her in this condition. Reverb!"
The Praetor commander snapped his fingers. Two guards shuffled forward and dragged Piper to her feet. One waved a small bottle under her nose. Smelling salts, perhaps? Or some vile magical equivalent of Medea's? Piper's head snapped back. A shudder ran through her body, then she pushed the Pandai away.
"I'm fine!"
She blinked at her surroundings, saw Jason and Meg in their wind columns, then glared at Caligula. She struggled to pull her knife, but her fingers didn't seem to work.
"I'll
kill you.
Caligula chuckled. That would be amusing, my love. But let's not kill each other quite yet, eh? Tonight, I have other priorities.
He beamed at me.
Oh, Lester, what a gift Jupiter has given me. He walked a circuit around me, running his fingertips along my shoulders as if checking for dust. I suppose I should have attacked him, but Caligula radiated such cool confidence, such a powerful aura that it befuddled my mind.
Not much left of your godliness, is there? He said.
Don't worry. Medea will coax it out of you.
Then I'll take revenge on Zeus for you. Have some comfort in that.
I don't want revenge.
Of course you do.
It will be wonderful.
Just wait and see.
Well, actually, you'll be dead, but you'll have to trust me. I'll make you proud.
Caesar,
Medea called from her side of the dais. Perhaps we could begin soon. She did her best to hide it, but I heard the strain in her voice. As I'd seen in the parking garage of death, even Medea had her limits. Keeping Meg and Jason in twin tornadoes must have required a great deal of her strength. She couldn't possibly maintain her Ventus prisons and do whatever magic she needed to de-god me. If only I could figure out how to exploit that weakness.
Annoyance flickered across Caligula's face.
Yes, yes, Medea.
In a moment.
First, I must greet my loyal servants.
He turned to the Pandai who'd accompanied us from the Ship of Shoes.
Which of you is Wawa?
Wawa bowed, his ears spreading across the mosaic floor.
Here, sire.
Served me well, have you?
Yes, sire.
Until today. The Pandos looked like he was trying to swallow Tiny Tim's ukulele.
They tricked us, Lord, with horrible music.
I see, Caligula said. And how do you intend to make this right? How can I be sure of your loyalty?
I pledge you my heart, sire. Now and always. My men and I.
He clamped his huge hands over his mouth. Caligula smiled blandly. O Reverb. His praetor commander stepped forward.
Lord.
You heard Wawa?
Yes, Lord.
Reverb agreed.
His heart is yours, and also his men's hearts.
Well then. Caligula flicked his fingers in a vague go-away gesture. Take them outside and collect what is mine. The throne room guards from the port side marched forward and seized Wawa and his two lieutenants by the arms.
No!
Wawa screamed.
No! I didn't mean...
He and his men thrashed and sobbed, but it was no use. The golden armored Pandai dragged them away. Reverb gestured at Crest, who stood trembling and whimpering next to Piper.
What about this one, sire?
Caligula narrowed his eyes.
Remind me why this one has white fur.
He's young, sire,
Reverb said, not a trace of sympathy in his voice.
Our people's fur darkens with age.
I see. Caligula stroked Crest's face with the back of his hand, causing the young Pandos to whimper even louder. Leave him. He's amusing, and he seems harmless enough. Now, Shoe Commander, bring me those hearts. Reverb bowed and hurried after his men. My pulse hammered in my temples. I wanted to convince myself things were not so bad. Half the Emperor's guards and their commander had just left.
Medea was under the strain of controlling Tuventi. That meant only 6 elite Pandai, a killer horse, and an immortal emperor to deal with. Now was the optimal time.